This WBEZ podcast is supported by The Auditorium, presenting Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater, April 24th through the 26th. Experience the power, passion, and athleticism under the direction of newly appointed artistic director, Alicia Graf Mack. Plus, five Chicago premieres showcasing the bold innovation and artistry that have made Alvin a global cultural treasure. Tickets at auditoriumtheater.org.
What's up, Chicago? I'm Erin Allen, and this is The Rundown. It's almost time to vote for the next president of the United States. So much has happened, it's hard to believe we're so close. And a key demographic in this election, and actually in most election cycles, is Black women.
Black women are superlative participators in American democracy.
This is Professor Sally Niema, and her research is about just how much Black women participate in the democratic process as voters, as activists, as office holders. She says Black women are model citizens.
In any given local election or even at the national level, maybe Americans are voting at 30 or 40%. Black women are consistently voting at twice that rate. Mm. That's at the national level. If you look at the local level, too, Black women tend to be really involved, not in just in terms of voting, but we know across nonprofit organizations, economic development organizations, church institutions. Before they had the opportunity to vote in 1965, Black women were critical for the establishment of organizations that facilitated other people's rights to vote. So when I describe Black women as model citizens, I think that if there was a textbook definition of what citizenship means, they would be it.
Professor Niema grew up in the neighborhood Commons, which is right around the Cabrini Green area of Chicago. And she says she got interested in researching this because of the activism by Black women that she witnessed in that area back in 2013. This is when Chicago closed dozens of CPS schools that had majority Black students. She was interested in why Black women consistently participate in democracy, even though their representation in public office at the national level is so lacking.
Post-Reconstruction, we've had two elected Black women senators. And at the gubernatorial level, we've had no Black women governors. Mm. And then we obviously have had no Black women presidents. If you consider the fact that Black women vote more than most Americans, at least for the past 20 years, and if you consider the fact that in addition, they're really critical to registering people to vote, organizing protests and rallies, fundraising, and a whole number of other kinds of forms of engagement, this is sort of inconsistent with what you would expect from a representation standpoint.
Today, Professor Niema is going to get into why Black women continue to participate anyway.
Professor Sally Niema teaches political science at Northwestern University. Her current research focuses on the history of Black women engaging in the political process. Professor Niema, welcome to The Rundown.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about some of the beginnings of Black women participating in democracy in America. Let's talk about Fannie Lou Hamer. She was punished for participating in the democratic process. Tell me about her story.
Yeah, absolutely. So Fannie is one of my favorites, as if I know her. But Fannie Lou Hamer, becomes a really important piece of sort of the civil rights era, even though she's not named in sort of the big six because of the ways that race and gender work in America. Mm. Nonetheless, she became really important for creating the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Movement. And so Fannie Lou Hamer becomes essential in essentially signing up and registering people to vote and advocating, petitioning for Black people to have the right to vote, because we have to keep in mind, right, until the 1964 Civil Rights Act and then the Voting Rights Act of 1965, Black people do not have the full ability to vote, and nor are they considered full citizens. Mm. And so she's doing work before this period that helps facilitate and culminate in these actions.
This is 60 years ago. Let me just name that roughly, right?
100%.
Within the lifetime of my mother, my grandmother.
Same. And so Fannie Lou Hamer becomes essentially critical for being able to facilitate that change. But in order to receive that change, she and among other people end up being subjected to severe levels of violence. Mm. So Fannie Lou Hamer actually talks about in a testimony in 1963 at the Winona County Jail, the ways in which a group of her and other organizers were corralled and imprisoned and essentially beaten and stomped and severely sort of punished. And this ends up creating a disability that Fannie Lou Hamer has to sort of live with for the rest of her life. This is one concern among many others. Some Black women experience sort of sterilization. There's so many ways in which bodily harm was produced as a consequence of working to try to establish voting rights that we eventually ended up securing in 65.
That is so troubling. I want to talk about another important figure, Shirley Chisholm, the first Black woman elected to Congress back in 1968, only a few years after 1965.
Not a coincidence.
She ran for president 4 years after that. What about her story strikes you the most?
Yeah, Shirley Chisholm is a really important figure, especially considering Kamala Harris's run right today. So as you mentioned already, she becomes the first Black woman elected to Congress and then the first Black woman who's seeking a major party nomination for president in 1972. But as a congresswoman, she ends up introducing over 50 pieces of legislation and wins, I think, 6 to 7 terms. So I think that's really important to keep in mind that a lot of the policies that we are experiencing that continue to sort of be upheld in the years after that create this particular political moment are initiated by Shirley Chisholm. She doesn't just become the first Black woman, but she becomes the first for many things, including she becomes the chair of the House and Rules Committee, which is one of the most powerful committees within Congress, and introduces legislation around race and ethnicity, so specifically race-based and gender-based legislation, as well as legislation around the Vietnam War. So very progressive things. So catch her memoir, Unbought and Unbossed, if you want to learn more about Shirley Chisholm. But ultimately, exactly, it tells you who she is. But ultimately,
that's such a timeless title. Also, I'm like, yes, Unbought, Unbossed.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And so, yeah, becomes a really great model, not for just being the first, but for the kind of work that she ends up producing and initiating.
In terms of other representation when it comes to Black women, there was Senator Carol Moseley Braun, 1992, first Black woman elected to the U.S. Senate. And then Kamala Harris, 2016. And then the third Black woman senator is LaFonza Butler, who was appointed by California Governor Gavin Newsom last year. So these are a few examples of Black women in national office. Just to name this as well, there have been a number of Black women who have served in the House of Representatives, over 50. But that's still a very small number. That's only 0.5% of all the members of Congress ever. And I just want to see if you can put this in context, because those are important examples, but it's really still not that much representation.
Absolutely not. when you consider the long lineage of participation related to Black women, even before they formally had the right to vote, that really is not aligned with sort of what you would expect, just given their just fundamental level of participation in terms of voting, but even their civic participation more largely.
Let's get to the big question that is in my brain right now. Why do Black women vote and participate at such a high rate in our democracy despite such a lack of representation?
This is the golden question. There are many ways to answer this, but some of the things that I and others think about is, one, from the beginning, participation for Black women has always been about more than just themselves. So even if the outcome isn't representation or policy change, that isn't necessarily a reason not to participate, given that the ethos of participation has always been about making democracy be what it's supposed to be. If we go back to Fannie Lou Hamer, for example, there's an interview, I'm going to paraphrase this, where she's asked, so what do you want? Do you just want what the white man has? And she goes, I don't want that. That's too low for me. I want us all to have better.
Yes.
Right? Yes. And so they're participating, I think.
It's the collective upgrade for me.
Exactly. Yes. So they're participating in this idea that we're going to create a democracy that's actually more akin to what it's supposed to be like, right? And we're moving towards that. That's what we're doing this work for. The other piece, and this is important from a political science perspective, is that Black women don't have sort of the free rider thing that other groups have. What do I mean by that? I mean that a typical American whether they decide to vote or not, might still benefit from the fact that someone else votes. So mm-hmm. even if I don't go to the polls, mm-hmm. right, the fact that someone else votes might mean that ultimately I'll still benefit.
Sure.
Black women from the beginning of time, from the Kampahai U-River Collective to everyone else, describes the fact that they don't have anyone to participate for them if they don't participate, mm-hmm. right? So if you think about the fact that they largely support the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party contains, for example, immigrant groups for whom may not be able to vote for a number of reasons.
Sure.
And then Black men who, because of policies facilitated by mass incarceration, you know, and by the right. powers that be, may be in spaces where they can't vote because they're in prison. And that's a state policy issue, and or have felonies that keep them from voting, again, based on the state and their policies. That also really removes the ability for them to maybe engage at times at the rates that would really support Black women. So they may find themselves in a situation where there's no one there to participate if they don't, mm-hmm. especially considering that white women tend not to always align their votes with sort of progressive issues related to what Black people sort of may need.
Yeah.
And so participation becomes akin to a kind of survival. Just to maintain your conditions and hopefully improve them.
Yeah.
And so I think those two things help to explain some of why we see that participation anyway.
You have also pointed out that representation is important, right? For us to be able to look and see a Shirley Chisholm, a Kamala Harris is important. It's symbolic, right? But it's not the same thing. It's far from the same thing as actual policy that would benefit Black women. Can you talk about the difference there?
Absolutely. In political science, we talk about this as the difference between symbolic representation and substantive representation. Mm. So symbolic is when someone looks like you descriptively, usually through a demographic or, you know, ascriptive characteristic, but it does not necessarily translate to the improvement of policies for people who look like you.
Mm-hmm.
Substantive is sort of what that is, right? When you actually get policy change that is reflective and helpful for people who look like you. And
similar to what you talked about with Shirley Chisholm when she was in office.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so this becomes important because ultimately the reason why people want these folks who look like you to be in office is because you think it's going to improve your material conditions.
Yes.
And one of my central concerns in my work is the presumption, in democracy that Black women will engage in what I actually call political labor without sort of compensation in the form of democratic policy change.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you have—
Return on investment, so to speak.
Essentially.
Yeah.
So what you have is essentially people who are constantly engaged in sort of the political work and electing people into office, but you don't see a requisite change in their material conditions. Their lives aren't necessarily better.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we really want the latter more than anything. And so that's what I am interested in thinking more about in my own work.
Yeah. Let's get into the latter part there. Earlier this month, NPR reported that Black girls get nearly half of the most severe school punishments, like expulsion in public schools, even though they represent only 15% of girls in public schools, which is according to a report from the Government Accountability Office. Mm-hmm. But this should come as no surprise to you. I mean, this is another area of your research. How does that affect how they participate in democracy?
I'm really glad you asked that. So it's really interesting to consider the fact that typically experiences with the criminal justice system are associated with the lower levels of participation. Why? Because when you are imprisoned or incarcerated or experience arrest by the police, it tends to sever the social and financial resources needed to participate. For Black women, we actually see that it exacerbates their participation. So they participate more.
Interesting.
This exhausts me.
First of all, wait, what? Secondly, no.
Yeah. So it's like you're experiencing racism, sexism, classism, barely surviving maternal child, you know,
childbirth. Yep.
And then you may get arrested. You might be jailed. You might have your child removed, right? Those are all, you might be sanctioned by the welfare. Those are all examples of criminal justice experiences. And yet people are still participating in protests and organizing, and in states where they can, they're still voting.
I am exhausted by that. Like, I had so many reactions in that moment when you said that, you know.
Right, visceral, right? Like, ancestral ones. And that's actually why I call it labor. Because it's, I think, just as Americans work to eat, like, not work because you kind of have to, you know, or because you want to, rather. You work because you need it to eat.
Yes.
I think that Black women are still engaging in this labor because they sort of must.
Wow. Kamala Harris would be the first Black woman elected president if she's elected, which would mean a lot symbolically to a lot of people. From a policy perspective, do you know if Kamala Harris has outlined policies that would benefit Black women?
So that is actually a complicated question and answer.
Okay.
So the reason why is because there are some things that could indirectly be helpful. So, for example, there is a proposed policy to have a $25,000 subsidy for anyone to try to buy a home. This is federally. Locally, policies like this exist. So putting it at the federal level puts it in the hands of sort of everyone. And that could be helpful to Black women in particular because they tend to be head of household. And so are the people who would then go try to purchase a home, likely. And the fact that they get access to that could be helpful. Another example of a policy that could be helpful is the child tax credit that they're trying to implement and increase. We saw a version of that during the pandemic. You know, having additional resources for your family, you know, is certainly going to help Black women more generally. But the reason why I would be cautiously optimistic about these policies is because they are universal. Mm-hmm. And this relates to the concern around presidents saying that, you know, I'm the president of all the people, right? Or I'm going to do policies that are for everyone.
This is what former President Barack Obama has done and what Kamala Harris is kind of positing as well.
Correct. And so what that creates is a situation where you're focusing more on these sort of race neutral policies, which doesn't allow you to account for the ways that structural inequities, in particular structural racism, has created disparate outcomes. And so we know from research on race conscious versus race neutral policies that you need race conscious policies, and in this case, race and gender conscious policies, in order to redress things that have happened because of racism and sexism in the past. So if you give everyone $25,000, right, you don't necessarily create a context under which people who were left behind because of racism and sexism will be able to catch up.
Yes. Period. The end. When we talk about substantive representation versus symbolic representation, have you seen examples of that seemingly symbolic representation leading to actual policy change, leading to actual substantive change?
That's a good question. I know that for a work, there's work on and gender studies on women writ large, not necessarily Black women, that talk about like what happens when you get more women in Congress. And it basically shows that you do see there's more proposed legislation around like maternal health, around, you know, maternity leave, different policies around like precondition of being pregnant and how that affects insurance, right? So you do see that oftentimes symbolic representation for women translates to more substantive policy proposals.
Okay.
At the local level, though, if you think about like the Evanston Reparations Initiative, I think that's a really interesting example of like they know and can track, right, the inherent inequalities that a group of families face, Black families faced. And then they decided to give those families, right, resources. First, it was just for a house, but then they actually opened it up this past March so that people could get cash.
Yeah.
And that there's, of course, complications and challenges in terms of implementation, but it provides an opportunity for people to catch up. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is an example of the ways in which a person, you know, it was Black women who were critical for proposing that and helping to shape the terms to implement that. And while that's a more local level form of representation, we can see that that made a difference in terms of a policy change.
Yeah. What can other leaders, people like Kamala Harris and other people who have that type of power, learn from these more local policy changes that you've talked about?
I think you can see the learning already in proposing, for example, a $25,000 like home credit. Mm-hmm. But I think the bigger lesson to learn is that you can and probably should take seriously the idea of sort of race and gender conscious policies if you consider like affirmative action, even though it currently was voted, you know, down in the Supreme Court, we can already see the ways in which the removal of that has led to the decline in the number of students of color that attend these institutions. Mm-hmm. But the fact that we had it at all made a difference in so many people's lives. So oftentimes, people in power don't want to initiate this kind of policy because mm-hmm. they're concerned that it won't get passed, or if it does get passed, it'll be rejected. But at least it's something to defend.
Mm.
You know,
something is there for us to look to, speak to, amend, et cetera.
Work yeah. with.
Exactly.
And a big issue right now is like if you look at the national level, because there's been no major policies enacted on behalf of Black women, there's not even anything to sort of defend.
Mm.
You know, so I would hope that we could have more political will to propose specific policies that could actually improve their material lives in a substantive way. And that's directed so that we can actually reach equity, right, in democracy.
Professor Sally Niema teaches political science at Northwestern University. Professor Niema, thank you.
Thank you so much. This was a pleasure.
This episode is a part of the Democracy Solutions Project, which is a collaboration among WBEZ, the Chicago Sun-Times, and the University of Chicago's Center for Effective Government. It's a multimedia series that focuses on the critical issues facing our democracy in the run-up to the 2024 election. You can learn more at WBEZ.org. And that's it for today. Justin Bull and I produce The Rundown. Ariel Van Cleve is our editor and executive producer. Our theme music is by Louis Weeks. The Rundown is produced by WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. If you love this episode, please rate the show. Write us a review. It helps more people find The Rundown. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you on Wednesday.